Nicely done. So the theme for our month, hello, I see an old friend back there. So the theme for the month has been the bad habits of good people. And it's sort of a riff on a book by a man by the name of Joe Dispenza called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. So really what we're in a conversation about is, from a quantum point of view, how we are more of a pattern, more of a habit. We are more energy than matter, and how we work with that and what we want to do. So I want to explore that a little bit more this Sunday as we go on. So I want to talk a little bit about that. I always love talking about the ancient Hebrews and the wisdom that they give us. I want to talk a little bit about neuroscience because that's always interesting. But the thing I really want to talk to you guys about today are pink flamingos. Pink flamingos. So you may know this, and maybe you don't know this, but let me offer this to you. Do you know that flamingos are not pink by nature? They are not born pink. They are actually gray. They are a gray bird that eats a certain shrimp, and the shrimp has a certain pigment to it that causes it to turn pink. And I think that that's kind of an interesting metaphor for us, or for all things, because we are really a product of our diet. And what I mean by our diet is not just simply the food that we eat, but the associations that we keep, the things that we read, the things that we watch, where our attention is. My teacher says this. He says that where your heart is, so lies your treasure. So the things that we pay attention to most are really the pathway of what we are becoming, a lot like what the reading said. You know, and in Buddhism, they have a term that I love. It's called mental hygiene. And mental hygiene is, how do you feed your mind? Because how you feed your mind is going to kind of show up how you are. And of course, metaphorically speaking, we're talking about becoming pink flamingos, or whatever color we want, or whatever we want to be, who we want to be. How we become is a direct result of how we nurture ourselves. Really, it's where we give our attention. Another way of saying it is what we are loving. So there is a esoteric adage that says this, that says that the living are ruled by the dead. The living are ruled by the dead. And what that means is that often our lives are dictated by the past, by regrets, by fantasies of what was, it should have been, you know, the old, I could have been a contender. And so all these past things that exist in some mausoleum in our mind in the past that we continue taking the ability to create and do by paying mortgage on this old thing, this house of the dead, rules so many people. So really our conversation is wanting to move to something else, and where we are giving our attention is where we're developing and where we're growing and what we're becoming. And it happens at a personal level, but something else happens as well, and that is what happens at a collective level as well. And I want to talk about that. There was a very interesting phenomenon that happened somewhere around the time when Ronald Reagan, blessed be his name, was president. And it wasn't that he actually did it, but it speaks to the collective consciousness of where things were. So before him, in the realm of mental health, there was a tremendous amount of money, or not a tremendous amount, but there was a fair amount of money and research that was being done on how society affects who we are. And that who we are is a direct result of the collective community that we are in. In fact, there was a lot of writers that wrote about this, and Eric Fromm was one of them that I'll talk about in just a second. But what happened is this, is that the funding for research at that level began to shift from looking at that, looking mostly at the brain and the individual. And the medical model began to shift from looking at who we are as a collective to the brain itself. And the model of treatment for mental illness went from a therapeutic model to a pharmaceutical model. So that we began to treat the brain and to treat the brain from a chemical point of view, as opposed to looking at a more holistic enlarged expansion of who we are as social beings. And some interesting things began to happen that way. What happened is, and because we live in a culture that is a meritocracy, and what that means is that we are rewarded for certain things and punished for other things, is that certain behaviors and emotions are rewarded, and other ones are not. And so in our society, what's rewarded is, you know, put on a happy face and be ambitious, be friendly, be entrepreneurship. And all those kinds of things begin to be the things that we see as an ideal person, and our society and our culture rewards those things. But what also happens is that other things, like depression, like anxiety, like grief, like mourning, like the feelings that we have when we're trying to work something through are not rewarded. In fact, they're frowned upon. And what happens is that we have collectively begun to look that if a person is suffering, it's because of them. It's because they have done something wrong or they're not doing it. In fact, there's a book called Pastoral Care in the Age of Neoliberalism. It's a phenomenally brilliant book. But the author is a psychotherapist, and he talks about his years in psychotherapy. And what he began to notice is that his clients would come to him, and there was a difference. He noticed this difference in them, that when things like they were grieving, when they were mourning, when they were feeling levels of anxiety or depression, their immediate response was that there was something wrong with them, that it was my fault. And so what has happened is we've taken this idea that we are isolated. In fact, we reward that. We hold that up as, you know, as being self-reliant. But we have lost that ability to look where we are collectively and to think things happen. So one of my favorite authors was a man by the name of Eric Fromm. You always hear me say one of my favorite authors. You should see my library. But Eric Fromm, so back in the 50s, he wrote a couple books. He wrote a book called Escape from Freedom. And it was really a book on how we as individuals or collectively, we have a tendency to want to give away our authority. And what he was looking at was this was written in the 1950s, and he was one who recognized and saw the rise of totalitarianism in the world that he was in and where things were. And he talked about that. And he said, in the past, we worried about becoming slaves. In the future, we'll worry about becoming robots. But then he wrote another book called The Sane Society. And that was sort of a tongue-in-cheek book because he wasn't really talking about a sane society. He was talking about an insane society. And he developed a term called the pathology of normalcy, which is that if everybody is acting in a certain way, you know, if we're all cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, then we think that's normal. Or we normalize things that in a very real way may not necessarily be normal things. And one of the things that he says is the fact that a million people have the same pathology does not make those people sane. Just because we all believe something that is outrageous doesn't mean that outrageousness is right or good or true. And he goes on to say, he said, can we be so sure that we are not deceiving ourselves? Many an inmate in an insane asylum is convinced that everyone is crazy except themselves. right? Of course, it doesn't relate to anybody in this room or any particular nation or any particular culture that wants to impose itself. And there's also a very interesting phenomenon that happens with this, is that we have developed defenses to deal with that level of pathology. And let me give you an example. Years ago, I used to work in mental health. And I worked primarily with neglected and abused children. And we saw something very interesting in the treatment of the children that we were working with that is also very, very similar to what happens with people in the recovery movement, which is this, is that as children were getting healthier, what we noticed is that the family, consciously or unconsciously, would begin to sabotage the mental health of their children. And it's very similar to what happens in recovery, that a person is working on that and they are sober for a year and their partner goes out and buys them a bottle of wine to celebrate. And it happens a lot. In fact, there's a term for it, and it's called the identified client. Because as long as we have someone acting out, then we don't have to look at our stuff. So the scapegoat, the identified client, the one who is acting out, is a defense to the self-inquiry or us looking at our own self or what's going on. And of course, that doesn't relate to anybody in this room, it's those other people. And if they would just get their act together, we would all be happy. So we have this system then where there's a tremendous amount of alienation of what's acceptable and not acceptable. And there's ways that we deflect our own inner process onto someone else that keeps us at a certain place that we don't have to really register at where those things are, except what Fromm wrote about then, which is true today, is there's a tremendous amount of anxiety and isolation to the point where it affects how we as individuals, but also who we are as a culture, as a nation, and as a planet, how we can create and build and do. Because we can't do that. The bottom line is this, is as we begin to understand the operation of the brain, we begin to understand this, that the brain begins to think thoughts and create ideas based on the information. This is where that's that pink flamingo phase, right? That we begin to take information in, it affects our perception, and it begins how we see things. And then what happens, we have an emotional response to that. And the emotions create a chemical response in us that registers it as a memory in the body. And then what happens is we begin to act in certain ways in response to the chemical things because, you know, we learn by chemistry. That's simply how the brain operates and works. We learn by this, it anchors it in, and we create what's happening. And we do it, as Thoreau says, with monotonous repetitivity. And so Joe Dispenza has a quote in his book, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, that says this, quite simply, our routine known thoughts and feelings perpetuate the same state of being, which creates the same behaviors and creates the same reality. So if we want to change some aspect of our reality, we really have to think, feel, and act in new ways. We have to be different in terms of our responses to experiences. We have to become someone else. We have to create a new state of mind. We need to observe a new outcome with that new mind. In other words, it's very similar to what the founder of New Thought, or the founder of the Science of Mind and Spirit says, which is this. In this life, we don't get what we want. We don't get what we hope for. We get what we become. Because as we understand this, it is we have a thought, we have a feeling begins to flood our body with all these interesting chemicals, our brain begins to act in certain ways, we begin to operate in certain ways, and we begin to draw synchronistically, consciously, unconsciously into the very thing that we want. And we wonder sometimes about why we do affirmations and why we do vision boards and why we do all these kinds of things and nothing changes in us. It doesn't change in us because our emotions haven't changed. And we haven't challenged them. Now, the thing of it is, as human beings, we have the ability to direct that. So I want to talk a little bit about evolution, because there's a couple things in this that will make this a little bit more salient. So St. Paul says in the book of Romans that if we want to understand the very nature of divinity itself, how this intelligence operates, we just need to observe nature, because the divine is revealed in nature. In fact, in the early mystical schools, even the Jesus movement itself says that there are two great books of revelation. The first and the most important one is nature. The second would be the sacred scripture of whatever religious tradition that you're in. But to really begin to understand it is to look at nature. And one of the things that we know about nature, watching it, is that there is a subjectivity that is operating. We could say there's a mind present at the subjective level in nature. We see it. We see how trees operate in certain ways and how they respond to certain stimulus and how they respond to nature. We see that in animals. We see that in so many behaviors that we can say that there is this collective subjective mind that is operating in the world that we're in. We also understand that through evolution, that in this subjective mind, there also develops this objective mind, this ability to observe and to understand and see. And that's where we as humans are, because we operate both at the subjective level, mostly, but we can influence our subjective mind objectively, meaning we can influence our thoughts. You with me on this so far? I'm not going to go much further on brain science, but it's just kind of interesting to sort of know this, to sort of set the stage. Now, there has been, so living in a cosmos whose story is still being told and whose outcome is unknown, there is certain markers in an evolutionary process that we can see how nature begins to operate and how evolution furthers. And again, going back to, if we want to understand the nature of this divine presence in nature, we just observe nature. So there's a pattern. And the pattern is, and it is correlated to our own spiritual path, which is there's order, there's disorder, and there's reorder. Think about your life. Think about how it's going along, and all of a sudden you come home and 60 Minutes is at your front door, or you get a note or a call, or the IRS has sent you a letter, or whatever the case is. All of a sudden your life is ordered and predictable and state, and it's this way, and then there's disorder. And then from disorder becomes a new order, a new ordering of things. Now, most of us want to go from order to reorder without going through the disorder part, right? But there is no straight path. The bus doesn't go that way. So part of that evolutionary experience is order. My life is a certain way. Nature is a certain way. Whatever the experience is a certain way. And something happens that disrupts the order. And then there's this restructuring that begins to occur that brings a new order. And what Teilhard says is this new order, as evolution is moving, is always moving at a deeper level of complexity and always bringing us to a deeper level of unification. So how evolution is happening is as we learn, as we respond, there's a deeper level of complexity about things, and it's bringing everything, uniting everything together, that all creation. Okay? So an evolutionary event. The awakening of spiritual consciousness is a profound evolutionary event that ripples through the entire cosmos. And there's a couple things about what spiritual awakening does. You know, our early ancestors began to grapple at a spiritual level, because at one level they were trying to make sense of suffering. At another level, they were trying to find meaning in how things were, and it gave a sense of direction in how their life was proceeding. But there's something really important about what the evolution of spiritual consciousness brings. Order, disorder, reorder. What happened is it's begun to reorder the cosmos in a trajectory of rightness. That this infinite intelligence lures us, calls us forward with an idea of doing what is right, what is good, what is true, what is beautiful. So it's moving us in a certain trajectory, not simply dominance, not simply chaos, but there's a level of complexity about what is right. There's a level of complexity about what is good, what is true. And that level of consciousness brings a unification of all things. We see God in all things. We respond in reverence and we become in service. In fact, the ancient Hebrews understood this. In the early part of the time of the prophets, there was a certain prophet who set the tone for all this. His name was Meshach. And in the book of Meshach, chapter 6, verse 8, if you're following along, it says this. You know, it's asked, what does this divine presence want? How does the divine want us to respond to itself? And it says this. He has told you, human one, what is good and what this divine presence requires from you, to do justice, to embrace faithful love, and to walk humbly with your God. So in Hebrew, the word justice means rightness. And rightness is that thing that reorders or brings unification. So to act in a way that unites, doesn't dispel, that creates a sense of unity, to do that. In other translations, and what is said there, is to act with kindness. And to walk humbly means to know your place, to know who you truly are. And not in sort of a servile way, but to really embrace your own humanity. So there's an aspect of this that I want to talk about to bring these ideas together to another thing. So in our culture, how we create and what we do, we sort of reward certain feelings, and we sort of discredit other feelings. And one of those feelings is anger. Because as you know, we're all high, devout spiritual beings, and we're never angry, right? At least in front of other people, or when someone's watching. Except, anger is a good thing to feel. It's a healthy thing to feel. You should feel angry. It's what we do and how we do with it. Because, you know, our ancestors, as they were sort of moving across the savannas of Africa and moving into Europe and in Asia and all that, they experienced anger as we experience anger. And anger is a natural response to provocation. Something happens. Something disappoints you. Something, an invitation wasn't kept. A commitment wasn't kept, something happens or something provokes us, and we respond in anger. It's a healthy thing to do because, you know, the brain creates this emotion of anger. It throws this dopamine in us. It fires us up, and we're ready to act and respond. Now we are evolving. And so as human beings, probably the best thing for us not to do when we are provoked is to pick up our club and go looking for a fight, because that's not leading us to a level of complexity or unification. But really, what anger is it's a response to a provocation and a desire for justice. You with me on that? So when we are angry, we want a level of rightness. We want things, we want to move from disorder to order. And how we begin to understand that from this spiritual place of doing it rightly is not simply to sit in that emotion and stew in those chemicals, but rather to channel that. Because as human beings, we have the power objectively to influence our subjective mind, which means We can have an experience and through our thoughts say, what am I going to do with that? And how am I going to respond? And what I know is it's right for me to feel angry. It's right for us to feel angry with the things that are going on. But we don't channel that in simply the most barbaric way, but we channel that in a way that brings goodness, that brings rightness, that brings beauty, that brings truth, because that response brings that level of complexity. That response brings that level of unification. So when you are angry, realize it's okay to be that way. It doesn't mean you get to stay that way. And it doesn't mean that you're wrong because you're not having happy thoughts. It means that you are right where you are supposed to be. And then the next question is, what am I going to do with that? And what is my guide? What is my vision? How is the divine drawing me, luring me, giving me an opportunity? And it is to respond with love. It is to respond with rightness. It is to respond with compassion and goodness and kindness. Because when we do that, we reorder where the world that we're wanting to create. We reorder. And this again is what the ancient Hebrews, it's what the early followers of Jesus understood, that it is this idea of the kingdom of God, this idea of this reorder in such a way where there is forgiveness, where there is reconciliation, where there is healing, where there's novelty and the making of all things new. So, my beloved flamingos, what feeds your mind? What feeds your mind? And in feeding your mind, you know, what are the emotional and chemical responses that are going on, and how can we do it in a new way? So let's pray. Let's take all of that, and let me not fall over, and breathe. Because when we breathe, everything changes. When we breathe, we have that moment of introspection. When we breathe, things balance. We can direct our thought. We can cool the mind and all of its chemical activities. Recognizing that in this moment right here, there is a loving presence that we become aware of that is inviting us to a deeper level of goodness. That through that experience of grace that we can accept that we are accepted, that we can accept that we are loved, that we can accept that there is an intelligent cosmos that desires our good. And in doing that, we know that the good that we are seeking is seeking us. And so we move into an emotional and conscious state of gratitude, of expectancy, of good. We change the chemical being of our mind in alignment with that which is right and good and true and beautiful. We breathe in gratefulness. We breathe in joy. Creating this new world order and giving thanks in this moment and allowing ourselves to be surprised by the novelty of that which is, we let it be, and so it is. Thank you.